Welcome to minute 73 of season 8 of Movie Grub Minute, the daily podcast where we foobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today on Hump Day is Niall McGowan of the Bat Minute. Welcome back to the humping day.
I have to say, I didn't sign on for a humping day. I think we're going to have to renegotiate the podcasting contract here, Rob.
No comment.
For legal reasons, you can't bring up anything right
now. That's right. That's right. All right. So minute 73 begins with Upham trying to rethink his plan and ends with explosions in the distance as the men advance. So we ended things yesterday with Miller and Upham discussing the money, the potential windfall that they might have here with the whole thing. And, you know, Miller ended yesterday's minute with him basically saying, well, what if we don't live that long? Mm. And, you know, it actually was a great place to end the minute. Because of the way that they did it, and you look between the two of them, the look that the two of them have, there's like a little bit of a pause, and then Upham goes 500. He goes, yeah, 500 would be good.
Yeah, again, it's just something to break that tension. It's just like, and also it kind of shows a more of that Upham, after been rattled for so long, have been like just in the situation, and also with Miller as well being a figure of authority. The fact that he's the one to cut the tension with the 500 been good, like, it's sort of like, oh, these guys are they're comfortable with each other now,
right? He's finally realized that, wait a second, we don't need to go that high here.
yeah but also I think he's just like, oh, this is a guy I can kind of, I don't need to be so pent up and so nervous around anymore. It's like, no, he's like, we're kind of settled with each other now as well. So I think that's a nice little moment too. But it really is, like, considering, we've had, between days here as well to, like, ponder mortality, basically. Because that's what, essentially, Miller is, the way he's phrasing that, though, like, what if we don't live that long, is really kind of emphasizing, like, we are here, like, it's quite likely we're not going to make it out of this. Like, at some point, all our time here, we just might not make it. Like, we just end up, we're really facing death at every given moment. So,
correct.
Yeah, it's a horrible thing, because everybody at every point in life is facing death constantly, because you never know what could happen.
True, but you're not in a combat situation. Like,
you're in a situation. Yeah, this is a situation here. Was like, to quote Marge Simpson, they go, "It's designed to hurt. It's designed to hurt." So you're in war. They're trying to kill you. Like, that's their whole thing. The reason you're there is to try to kill somebody else as well. So it's but I do like, though, that it's, it really conveys that him and up on Miller now, like, a bit more, they're not like buds, but they're like, he at least, after going through a period of him being like the novice next to a kind of like slightly grumpy sergeant or grumpy captain, sorry, I keep saying sergeant, but he's a captain, the fact that the Upham feels relaxed enough to be the one to break the tension with the 500, is nice. I think it's a nice moment.
Right. I mean, I like the way that they deliver that line and the humor with it, but the problem is there really much of a difference between 500 and 1,000 if they're talking about, letting this pool go? I think, in from a real perspective, if you're looking at that, you'd say, well, okay, let's just take the 300 and be happy with what we got.
Yeah.
Because we might not live long enough to get 500. Because again, as I mentioned yesterday, getting 500 means they have to get 140 new guys in the unit in order for them to get that money. I mean, that's going to take a while till they, first of all, they have to rejoin another unit and stuff like that. It's not so simple.
It's going to get to a point where, like, we have to just create our own army, basically.
Just to be able to get not 140 men, another 40 men. Sorry.
Yeah.
40 men.
But they're putting up then, they're kind of like, I want I want you posters. And then at the bottom, it just says to pay $5 to get into my platoon.
That's right. So we've been talking the last few days about this whole betting pool. So what do you know about betting pools?
I was a little bit confused by the pool because I don't know if basically someone manages to get it out of him, they win. But then, so when he then just tells everybody at the same time who he is the pool dissolved? Does anyone get it?
Of course, because there's no guests anymore.
There's no guests, so yeah. So that's a bit of a... To be fair, actually, maybe I'm changing my mind about what so Miller is then, that he just denied them all that money. Like, they never know who... That thing was keeping them alive, man. That was keeping hope alive, was that pool. And to come in and like, you know what? None of you are getting it. It feels like it was a very parental move in that moment then. Like, you know, oh, Sizemore, you're threatening so-and-so with a gun. And everyone's roaring at each other. And it feels very much like a kind of, oh, you know what? I'm going to turn this car around and no one's going to go to Disneyland. So everyone's, yeah, well, you know what? I'm a teacher. Your pool's gone, assholes. So shut up and get in line. But no, I've never been part of a betting pool.
Well, even like for, I don't know, the Oscars or sporting events or things like that, you've never been part of things like that?
I've done it. At the times in the Olympics, I've done bets with people, like literally sitting around the table going like, okay, so here's, you know, over here be 50p, but like, oh, 50p on this person to win, et cetera, et cetera. But I was always one-on-one betting. It was never a pool scenario. Right. It was never like, oh, you're going to get a whole big, you know, everyone's putting into a pot kind of thing. It was just more like, I'm betting you, other person against me, that this is going to go this way. So no, I've never been involved in a long ongoing pool.
Right. No, I know that there are like, you know, there's different sports pools, like the Super Bowl and things like that. And there's, you know, March Madness, you know, which is college basketball, stuff like that. I'm not a sports person. So, you know, I don't partake in any of those things. And I do, I sort of do an Oscar pool, but I don't do it for money. You know, because it's all random, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's really worth doing it that way and stuff like that. But whatever. But
yeah,
it's just
yeah.
an interesting idea that they've added into this movie, the whole idea of having this betting pool, you know, of trying to figure out, okay, you know, let's see how many people we can convince to pay $5 that will hopefully try to find out what Captain Miller actually did in real life. You know, like who he really is. And on the other hand, you'd say like, who cares?
No, I think it's a really good move though, because one, it humanizes all the soldiers you're with. It gives them a thing in common that you yourself as a person can empathize with, because it's a very human thing for them to be asking these questions and then making a game of it. It's sort of like, oh, you know, it's a bit of camaraderie that they have. And it also informs you as well about Miller in that the fact that he hasn't told them is that he's, you know, what's the saying about him that like they can't get this information out of him?
Well, that actually makes sense because, you know, it's a question of you know, you're supposed to have some sort of dissonance between commanders and the soldiers under their command, which in a way is there to make it easier for them to make different, you know, command decisions, you know, deciding which man goes where and you know, who you have to send to go do something, stuff like that. It's, If you're too emotionally connected to the men, you're gonna say, oh well, I'm gonna send a guy that I don't know as well.
Yeah, you know, I think also too, like you could be like, it's to make sure that the chain of command is still very clear, because you could have a guy in a platoon who's saying like, you know, back in the day he was like an up and coming stockbroker or something, and he had like, you know, a really good job, and then he got like drafted or he volunteered, et cetera, et cetera. And then him finding out that his captain is like a janitor would be like, oh, well, why am I listening to this guy then? Like, you know, it would bring the real world over into a scenario where like, it doesn't matter who you were over there.
Right. Like, is true. Here, also.
This guy's in charge. It doesn't matter what he was outside of this. He's just now this person who's telling you what to do. And yeah, you know, you can be curious about it and stuff. And everyone naturally would be curious because you're like, oh, what did you do back in the world and stuff? But it's supposed to be like, no, you keep that entirely separate because you can't get you know, confused about like who's in charge and what your position is here, because if it starts getting murky, things start getting messy, you know?
Right. So, exactly. No, 100%. It's the way they do it. And at this point, Miller just turns to him and says, get some sleep, Corporal. And he goes, yes, sir. Mm. So again, it's a nice little moment between these two characters to show that they're forming some sort of a connection. It's not the type of connection that's going to be a big connection, but you know, when you're in war, the idea is when you're in battle, the idea is you have to have people that you can count on.
Yeah.
You know, so just having this small little moment between them says something also. And it also shows us that Miller is still not breaking, breaking his silence on things.
Yeah.
You know, he's still keeping himself a bit away, you know, a bit further away.
Yeah.
So
I think also too, it's just like, because Upham is our audience surrogate character as well. Basically, like, you know, you always need a character who's coming into the world. In order for us to get to know the established characters in here, like the rest of the platoon, you need someone who's coming in from the outside.
Right.
So the audience can be like, oh, that why are they telling each other everything? Oh, because they have to inform this guy. And Upham serves that role in the movie. And I think him and Miller getting a little like, you know, he's getting more familiar with Miller and more comfortable with him is like a sort of segue for the audience now feels more comfortable with him as well.
Right.
I mean, now, you know, and we get to feel like, oh, if our guy Upham is happy with this guy, then we all are, kind of thing. And if he doesn't like Tom Sizemore, it's an indication that you shouldn't like Tom Sizemore, like that kind of thing, you know?
Well, there's a reason why people don't like Tom Sizemore, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. I remember he popped up in Twin Peaks. I was like, people are still casting Tom Sizemore and things. Like, apparently so. Yeah.
Oh, it was unbelievable. I mean, I was recently doing research about him about something, and I saw how many movies he was in over the last decade. You know, up until he mysteriously died. You know, but it was just like, whoa. It's like, where is all that coming from?
He had such a bad. Yeah, he had such a bad reputation. You think no one would want to touch him. It's like, still just kept on working. It's like, wow. Maybe he just had friends. He just had friends in high places or, you know, he was just in with people. But, yeah, weird. I mean, it's the same thing. We're coming out the day after the news breaking of Jared Leto playing Skeletor in this Masters of the Universe movie. It's just like, how are they still hiring this guy? Like, everybody hates him. Everyone thinks he's a joke. And it's like, he's still getting parts that big? Apparently, yeah. God knows the way that industry works. It's crazy. But get an actor very happy to still be getting work though is of course Jeremy Davies. Like you're saying, you kind of associate him most with the Lost, Rob. That'd be your sort of big connection to him.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because he's just I think I always knew cause he's in so many. Great little things, Jamie Davies. That I always want to shout him out when he appears because he's such a good, reliable character actor. But he's in I'm a big fan of Hannibal. The Hannibal Lecter TV show. Mm-hmm. Have you seen Hannibal?
No, I've seen all the movies, but I never got around to watching the TV show.
Oh, the show is so it's the best. It's literally the best rendition of all of that. It's like if you want to see. It's better than the Thomas Harris books it's based on. It's better than all the movies. It's just the best.
But it doesn't have Anthony Hopkins.
But, Jay.
How can it be good if it doesn't have Anthony Hopkins?
No, I don't like Anthony Hopkins. Ah. Like, I think he's too hammy. And then Mads Mikkelsen's just perfect. He is to me, that's what Hannibal Lecter is Mads Mikkelsen. Okay. But, like, Jerry Davies pops up in two episodes. I think his character is supposed to have been, like, he's a stable hand guy. And he's supposed to have been kicked in the head by a horse, so he's just not all there anymore. And there's crimes going around the farm, but at one point you think he's the killer, but it turns out it's actually like his social worker is the killer in the episode. But then Jeremy Davies figures this out beforehand, but because he can't really communicate it well, he has to take action himself. And there's a bit then where Hugh Dancy's Will Graham is talking to him, and Jeremy Davies is sitting down with by the corpse of this horse. And he's sort of, Will Graham puts everything together. And then he comes out with the immortal line, because Jeremy Davies' character is called Peter. He says, "Peter, is your social worker inside that horse?" And Jeremy Davies is like, "Yeah." And they open up the horse, and he knocked out his social worker and sewed him inside a dead horse.
Oh, wow.
And you see this guy coming out of the hole. But yeah, that's the kind of show it is. Like, it's a very baroque, very gory, but very weird and beautiful piece of work. And yeah, so for a long time to me, Jeremy Davies is like, oh, the guy from, he's in Secretary. He's like Maggie Gyllenhaal's boyfriend when you're hoping she's going to get together with James Spader eventually. Jeremy Davies is the obstacle. He's Justified, you know, he pops up quite a bit in that show, but now to me he will forever be, oh yeah, Peter the horse sewing guy in Hannibal. So, and yeah, he's got that thing too where he's I have a friend who was an actress back, you know, good few years ago, and she worked with a lot of people in New York, and she just got around with a lot of people. And so every time you mention any kind of indie movies and stuff from the mid-2000s, she's always like, oh, I hooked up with that guy. Or like, you know, Clifton Collins Jr. You know, if he pops up, mm-hmm. She's like, you know, I had a thing with Clifton Collins Jr. And like that guy who was in Past Lives last year, she's like, yeah, I used to go out with that guy. Yeah, dumped him in the street, et cetera, et cetera. And it's so many. Like, when The Penguin was on, she's like, that guy, that corrupt cop. Yeah, me and him used to be a thing. It's like, Jesus Christ, lady, how many of these guys did you go out with back in the day? These mid-2000s indie movie actors who've like now getting into the genre stuff. And so when I was talking about Jeremy Davies, I just had to go like, you and Jeremy Davies, nothing, right? And she's no, I never hooked up with him. But I would have, though. she knew who he was, but she was like, oh, no, I would. But I had to double check with her. It's like, there's a good chance. There's like an 80% chance that this lady's hooked up with Jeremy Davies at some point because he was her type and he was there at the time. But tragically, no. I thought I might have had a little, oh, I know someone who screwed this guy. But tragically, not. But he's also, I always highly recommend to if people are in for a little offbeat horror movie. He's also in Ravenous with Guy Pearce, which is a great, great unsung cannibal movie.
I wasn't that much of a fan of it. I've seen it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I love Ravenous. It's a very strange movie. Really brilliant soundtrack and stuff, and a very distinct kind of tone to it. It's so influential on Hannibal as well, weirdly, because all that the snowy landscape and just the whole kind of weird, warped humor of it. It's like, yeah, this is very Hannibal-ish. I can see where like Brian Fuller was pulling a lot of it from was from Ravenous. But yeah, the fact that Jeremy Davies walked the line, he's in both. It's like, oh, good for you, man. Good for you for getting around. Yeah. And as I say, yeah, iconic mullet as well. Just, you know,
oh, wow.
Wouldn't recognize him. Genuinely didn't recognize him without it. It was like, holy moly. But, and of course, yeah, he did recent. So he's good at comedy, sniveling, unlikable pricks. But then he's also in The Black Phone last year as like an abusive dad, and he's genuinely horrible in it. Like, you know, the point you want to break his jaw kind of thing.
Isn't it the point
to go from that up him? Yeah, that is the point, but he conveys it so well. But it's just like, yeah, that's acting, man. He played Upham, who was like one of the most likable characters in Saving Private Ryan, a guy you just want to hug and tell him it was going to be okay the whole time. And then, you know, on the other spectrum, he's the abusive dad in The Black Phone, who's just like, yeah, you deserve to get curb stomped, man. Like, how could you do this to your own children and stuff? Yeah, just great, great character actor. And now, like, I've never got to talk about him on the show before, but I just wanted to.
There you go.
He's a guy who's always been on my radar since back in the day. I always like when he pops up and stuff. So I was happy to see him appear in this. So, yeah.
And have the opportunity to talk about it.
Yeah. Particularly then, because the rest of the minute is so, it's weird because the remainder of this minute is like nothing actively happens, but it is great.
That's the thing. It's nothing really active, beautifully composed. You're 100% right. Nothing actually happens, but you know, the fact that they show us, you know, they show Miller just standing there, and we see him illuminated by the lightning and the sound of thunder in the background and stuff like that. And then they have this amazing transition that goes from inside the church to, you know, the outside, and you don't even know that it's the outside until, you know, we hear the sounds of thunder, and then we see the lightning, and it also, the sound of thunder, just like they did earlier in the movie, they do an amazing job of blending together the explosions and the thunder itself. Like there was a point where they had the raindrops and gunfire at the same time also. You know, the sound design in this movie is just unbelievable, you know, from that perspective.
The point you're questioning, was it thunder or was it, you know, explosions the whole time?
Exactly.
Like it's hard to tell.
Exactly.
And again, what's it saying though, like, you know, the rain and the gunfire interchanges, like that's the whole landscape. As natural as the rain and the storm is over there, is the battle.
That's right.
Like it's just like it's relentless. It's always sometimes there's always explosions going off. There's always people firing each other. That's just what that environment is.
Correct.
Really, and it's just the actual shot too of like the gray clouds with the flashes. It's just, and them marching across, it's like, that's just beautiful.
Yeah.
Like it's so, so well put together.
Yeah. And you see that they're just like silhouetted by the lightning, you know, every so often happening and stuff like that. It's just, and it does a great job of like setting the mood for what's happening and what's going on with these guys. You know, it's like on the one hand, you think it would be depressing, but on the other hand, it's, you know, we're on this mission that we have to go, you know, find this guy. And and also looking at it from the perspective that, you know, here you have the complete darkness, and then every few seconds there's like this bright light that is showing you who is there, and you're like, oh, wait a second, maybe this is also something that they're trying to tell us, that, you know, they're going into the unknown, and every so often they get these little ideas of where to check and where to look. You know, that type of thing.
Just how terrifying that would be though, just in that scenario as well. I've been walking across, it's like, yeah, there's explosions over there. Is on our side? Are they coming this way? Are we walking into that? Like, you don't know. You just have to keep going. Like, it's, it always struck me in this movie, the amount of times as well, where they're like, yeah, so we have to go do this thing. And it's like, okay, are they given a Jeep? Are they given a tank to go do it? No. It's like, you just gotta walk.
Well, no. Well, if you knew the backstory, in the original story, they're given a Jeep, and they get into an accident.
Oh, okay.
And there's a bit of an editing error in the movie that you do see them for 2 seconds driving by the screen in a Jeep. But then they don't explain anything about it. The rest of it was just cut out. So yes. So. And also the script talks about how they got the Jeep, which is also really weird, the whole thing. You know, that sort of, you know, they sort of stole it, and you know, whatever. No need to even go into all that again. You know, we talked about that.
I didn't question it. I was just like, you know, back then, just in terms of like, the army doesn't have a budget or the resources to give you a Jeep. So it's just like, yeah, you guys just have to walk to find this guy. Just struck me as like, yeah, I guess that makes sense. That'll happen. You know, it's I didn't question it. So yeah, it's a fair enough edit to be like, you don't need to see that, I suppose. But I'm assuming too, because a lot of this is actually, so when I mentioned to my dad, I was coming on, because he's, you know, he's a real, takes pride in anything vaguely Irish, anything vaguely Irish that pops up. And his main knowledge of Saving Private Ryan is like, oh, they filmed all of that in Ireland, right? I was like, yeah, they did. Yeah, they did that.
Yes.
Like, these scenes in particular, or like, you know, that shot, or that was shot in Ireland and stuff. But yeah, no, Dan, because he's from Donegal originally, and that's around, you know, nearby is where they're doing a lot of this stuff. Some of the Donegal beaches were filling in for Omaha and stuff. So I was very glad. But yeah, if they needed somewhere to just look really gray and miserable, where it looked like people wanted to die. Yeah, that's where you'd shoot. You'd go to Donegal, I suppose. This is actually—I'm only joking. Donegal is actually a lovely part of Ireland. It's a really beautiful part of the country. So, if anyone was ever coming over to visit, I would recommend checking out some of the areas that just didn't shot Saving Private Ryan in. You know, they actually had to like desaturate so much of it because it's actually a very bright and beautiful place now.
Well, it depends also what time of year they were filming. You know, we don't know that either.
Yeah.
But
I think the whole movie's just got that so much of that sort of, you know, porridge colored, desaturated, because even the American flag at the end, you're just like, oh yeah, remember that used to be red, white, and blue. It ain't anymore. Like it's kind of some color, I guess.
Yeah. Right?
But the whole thing's got so much of a muted tone about it and stuff.
Right.
But
exactly.
But still though, looks phenomenal.
Yeah.
All of it. Yeah.
For
yeah.
Sure.
Fantastic. That's Spielberg. I think he's got a future in the pictures, this guy.
Yeah, I think so too. I would agree with that. All right. So and that's how this minute ends. With these explosions and silhouettes in the background. So every Wednesday we have a segment called World War II Wednesday, where my guests will give their top five World War II movies. So Niall, yeah. Once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
World War II movies is such a kind of broad spectrum as well, though, because I started thinking like, well, what's in many ways, like someone will turn around and say, like, Taxi Driver is a Vietnam movie because it's about the aftermath of Vietnam. But like, is it though? Is it not about? It's like, no, that's what thematically that's what it's about. And you're like, okay, so I guess Taxi Driver is a Vietnam movie. So if I'm applying the same kind of logic, like I want to put in like Apt Pupil, the movie Ian McKellen,
yeah, of course.
Brad Renfro, mm-hmm. And because that to me is like that's a World War II movie in that it's all about like the haunting consequences of the Holocaust and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and all the everything that happened there. And I think it's a really excellent movie. Fantastic performance by poor Brad Renfro, RIP.
Yeah.
And Ian McKellen on fire as well. And it's really good, like really haunting rendition of just like, yeah, the mental scarring and like and how the events that happened there can still permeate throughout down through time, and it's like people's fascination with like just how inherently evil was the evil that was going on there and stuff as well. But then at the same time, I'll be like, is that technically a World War II movie though, or am I?
Well, again, I leave the interpretation up to you. Yeah,
yeah. So, if not though, and I'd also put in the same vein though, maybe like if it doesn't count, I'll put a movie I've only ever seen once, and I have no intention of ever watching again. But it was great. Grave of the Fireflies. I'd say it's a really good World War II movie, but it again is absolutely devastating. Have you seen Grave of the Fireflies,
Rob? Yes,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So you know, it's just not the type of thing you ever want to go back into again, basically. But to tell them things from the other side as well, though, the fact that it's set in Japan at the time, and your characters are Japanese children who have been won over by the propaganda and stuff, but at the same time, it humanizes everybody because it's showing you the consequences of like, well, yeah, they were sold this by their government, but also you really feel for these kids because of look at what happens to them. It's so horrific and stuff. And this was the war for everybody, you know. So yeah, really beautiful film in terms of how it was made, but also horrible movie in just what it's actually showing you. You know? Then I go a little bit more fun. I go for Stalag 17. Billy Wilder POW camp movie with William Holden,
mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those great early 60s, late 50s, early
60s. 1953.
Early 60s, late 50s, early 50s, early 50s. Late 40s movie. but yeah, fantastic movie. Just it's kind of got that sort of almost like a Sergeant Bilko kind of vibe to it, you know. Where there's a lot of like camaraderie amongst the guys in the ranks, but also there's a very serious storyline behind it, and it's all about people turning on each other, et cetera, within the scenario. And Billy Wilder is just one of the greatest filmmakers who's ever lived, and nearly everything that Billy Wilder does is so compelling. He's such a master of his craft. It's just like anything he made was worth recommending in general. And Stalag 17, I think, falls through the cracks a little bit. I don't think it's as remembered as, Someone Like It Hot or The Apartment or some of his big ones.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd really highly recommend people seek that out. Then I just go into, I'm going to indulge myself a little bit in going for one that's, it is a World War II movie outright. Also featuring Ian McKellen, weirdly enough. But it's more in my hokey interests would be The Keep, the Michael Mann movie. Have you seen The Keep?
I do not believe I have.
The Keep, I think they only just released it in 4K like this month, and it was kind of, it's Michael Mann. It didn't get a lot of good reviews. It was butchered in the edits, But it's basically, yeah, Nazi soldiers going into a castle in Romania. And Ian McKellen's like a scientist who comes with him who's in a wheelchair and stuff. And they come across a golem. You know, the Jewish folklore of the golem starts hunting them throughout the castle. And it's all the stuff. Scott Glenn appears, and he's a kind of weird supernatural character. Tangerine Dream did the soundtrack, so it's a lot of really beautiful synth work in it. And it's one of those things that's like, Michael Mann himself is kind of borderline disowned it, because he's just like, yeah, that was... It's supposed to be at least a half hour longer. I was forced to do a lot of cuts. People wanting his director's cut version is yet to be... I don't know if they'll ever get that put together kind of thing. But I just love it because of it's just spooky vibes and beautiful, you know, very all sort of dated 80s practical effects and, you know, synth score, McKellen killing it as a, you know, again, an evil scientist and stuff. And it's leaning into a lot of, there's a lot of campery about it, and it's a lot of silliness, but it's also genuinely got the elements of aggressive horror in there as well. And yeah, it's a good atmospheric, ominous, spooky vibe the whole time. So I just was like, I'll throw in The Keep, because that's it's technically set, it literally could have been set, well, actually no, I think it does, it has to be set during World War II though, because it does tie into Jewish folklore so much. And then that's obviously, if you have a Jewish folklore figure going after the Nazis, it's making a statement, you know?
Pretty so, much, yeah.
I was going to say it could be set during any war. Like, no, it actually, no, it very specifically has to be set during World War II. But it's also based on a great book, just called also The Keep by F. Paul Wilson. So if you don't like the movie, the book is the whole story. And you can sort of, if you want to delve into that first, maybe, you might get more enjoyment out of it. And then I'm gonna slightly cheat. My top one is a twofer.
Well, wait, you have, okay, that's what you're saying. Got it.
Yeah. So the top two are both Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List.
No, you gotta rank them.
You gotta, oh, come on, man. We're all friends here. Well, podcasting is hell, Rob. You gotta give each other breaks when we
can. I know, but how much supposed to give points if you don't? I agree with you that they are companion pieces. There's no question about that. But
yeah,
you still gotta say which one is slightly better than the other.
I'll do it this way. I'd say Saving Private Ryan then is a better World War II movie, whereas Schindler's List is a Holocaust movie. Let's put it that way, because Schindler's List is dealing so specifically with this element of the war, whereas Saving Private Ryan is more about like been out in the as it were, you know, out in the on the streets and in the fields, et cetera, et cetera. So for that purposes, I'll put that on top then. But also Schindler's List is, you know, they do beautifully go together, and it's obviously very, it's all material that's very close to Spielberg's heart, and you can feel that, you know, in both of them. I'll go, number 1.5 is Schindler's List, and number one is Saving Private Ryan.
Okay.
If we must do it that
that's
way.
Fair. That's fair.
But yeah. Because everything about Saving Private Ryan, it's all, you know, stuff you all talked about already, though, but it was just the fact that, like, when it came out, it really had that vibe of, you know, the Normandy landing sequence was just like no one had ever seen anything like that.
That's before. True.
Like, it was, you know, so beautifully but horrifically put together. And just the fact that literally that one sequence changed the way people think about, like, how do you shoot war scenes?
Correct.
How do you shoot battle scenes? Mm-hmm. How do you shoot any kind of gunfight scene now? Because everybody's seen Saving Private Ryan, and they know, well, that's more like what it was like, you know? Even Spielberg himself in War of the Worlds feels like in the attack sequences, he himself is trying to emulate, like, well, I can't go back now after shooting Saving Private Ryan and not have it be a bit like that because it worked so well. So I have to show people's ashes, you know, falling on top of Tom Cruise's head and stuff, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah. So, I would put that up. Maybe if someone put gun to my head and I had to recommend a World War II, if any movie that serves up World War II, in a succinct manner as possible, I would be like, Saving Private Ryan, but also Schindler's List at the same time. Because you kind of need they both balance each other out so beautifully as well. Because the two of them together really deal with that war as a whole spectrum, I feel. In terms of the battle, and then the nitty gritty of what it was about then, and in with the Schindler himself and stuff, and the actual politics of it and whatnot. But so I would put that as my World War II Wednesdays.
Okay, excellent. That is a great list. Thank you very much for that, Niall. Now, would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
I should have had an additional podcast to plug. Okay, I'll go for on That Minute and Miami Minutes are both presented by Sleepy Charlie Media, which is me and my friend John's our production company, as it were, which is just a figurehead for the podcast we put out. There's no actual offices or anything that makes it a proper production company, but we do have a Patreon. So if people like our content, we do a lot of Patreon stuff, wherein at the minute we have an ongoing series called VHS Capades, wherein we're reviewing each movie that had its trailer featured in the Batman 89 VHS release.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, when you got the VHS, you would have got trailers for Deadcom. What was the bomb ones? Was it the Living Daylights?
No. License to Kill was 89.
Yeah. We've already got that episode out. Do you think I would know it? that and Millennium and I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, and all. So we'll keep VHS Capades going throughout the Batman movies, you know, going forward. But we have other projects lined up as well. But that's our ongoing one at the moment, is that we've covered a lot of Batman comic stuff on there. There's a 1960s Batman album we got a review on up there. I think we have episodes about Falling Down. We have episodes about, like, the Joel Schumacher movie Falling Down. A lot of our bonus material all goes into the Patreon. So beyond VHS Capage, which is a very enjoyable show that we're doing right now. I think our next plan within the next year. Oh, also all our coverage of the Wednesday Addams show was on Patreon as well. That was Patreon exclusive. And I think this year, for various reasons, we're planning to cover all the movies of Madonna on there as well.
So yeah, have fun.
If you want to hear us talking about Dick Tracy and Evita, soon you will be able to for a mere $2 a month U.S. currency. they'll be coming down the pike soon enough. But Sleepy Charlie Media is where you get a lot of our bonus offshoot stuff. It's all good, I think. So,
all right, excellent. Thank you very much for that. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. You can send me an email to movearoundminute@movearound.net. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Facebook. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this, old chum.